Coming up on Fronteras, locals working with American troops abroad can find themselves in danger. Because of their work, there are special programs to make it easier for them to come to the U.S., but they still often face a very long wait.
And every one of them that's hunted down, every one of them that has to live in danger or has their quality of life diminished because they served with Americans, it's a tarnish to our national honor.
An American vet's quest to see an Iraqi family land safely on U.S. soil. And an immigration reform bill could call for more unmanned aerial vehicles patrolling the U.S.-Mexico border. Despite past problems with the border drone program, they're still championed as an important tool.
I think the drones have been effective continue to be so.
A look at what drones have done for border security. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among seven public radio stations. It's funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as part of its local Journalism Center initiative. I'm Crystal Chavez. Any immigration reform bill's going to have to address the issue of border security. The proposal a bipartisan group of senators is crafting calls for an expanded use of a specific and expensive tool that thus far has a questionable track record. From our Fronteras desk, Jill Replegal reports.
This airplane got a 66-foot wingspan, 36 feet long.
That's Michael Kostelnik describing a Predator B drone. He's the former head of the Air and Marine branch of U.S. Customs and Border Protection. The agency has 10 drones to patrol the border, and the senators working on immigration reform wanted to have more. CBP's drones are made by the San Diego-based company General Atomics. More controversially, the company also provides drones to the U.S. military to hunt down terrorists in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Yemen. On the U.S.-Mexico border, the drones are stationed at bases in Arizona and Texas, but they can be used to patrol as far west as San Diego. The drones provide what's called situational awareness. In layman's terms, knowing what's going on around you. Having eyes in the sky to help agents keep a watch on remote parts of the 2,000-mile-long U.S.-Mexico border seems obviously helpful, but critics say border officials have had a hard time showing results of the drones' work in securing the homeland.
The track record is abysmal.
Tom Berry is an expert on border issues at the left-leaning Center for International Policy based in D.C.
You know, they don't have a strategy. They don't have the infrastructure, the personnel to fly the drone.
Some of these are criticisms weighed by the Department of Homeland Security's own inspector general in a report last May. But that report didn't assess the overall value of the border drone program. So here's a very simplified attempt at a cost-benefit analysis. Cost. The government purchased each drone used on the border for about $18 million apiece, for a total of $180 million. They cost a little over $3,000 an hour to operate. They flew more than 5,700 hours in fiscal year 2012 for a total operating cost of at least $18 million last year. What did we get for that cost? According to U.S. Customs and Border Protection, last year drones helped seize more than 66,000 pounds of drugs and helped agents apprehend 143 people involved in illegal activity. That's less than 3% of all drugs seized by border agents and less than 0.04% of the 365,000 would-be illegal border crossers caught by agents last year. So are the drones worth their weight in taxpayer dollars? Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano says yes.
I think the drones have been effective continue to be so.
Supporters of the border drones say they make it safer for agents on the ground to do their job. They say the drones scare off smugglers and illegal border crossers. But perhaps there are less expensive aerial surveillance systems that could do the same job.
So these are high-resolution aerial images collected from a light aircraft.
In a small lab at San Diego State University, researcher Pete Coulter shows me some of the images he and his research team collected during a recent experiment using a piloted light aircraft. They went to a remote area of the border, attached a store-bought digital camera to the plane, and had it take periodic photos while team members on the ground moved themselves and their vehicles around.
And in some instances, you know, people are kind of standing next to bushes, trying to make it difficult to be detected.
Run through image processing software, the results were impressive. I could clearly see the shadow of a guy, it was Coulter, hiding in the bushes. Coulter says the aircraft used to take these images could easily be remote controlled, and the whole thing would probably cost around $300,000, a fraction of what a Predator drone costs. Researchers at SDSU think these types of small aircraft equipped with simple surveillance systems could be valuable assets in the quest to secure the border. And they're trying to get border authorities interested. But U.S. Customs and Border Protection is not looking at other options for drones, an official told me. In fact, the agency already has a deal with General Atomics to buy up to 14 additional Predators for the border. If the senators working on immigration reform insist on their drones, under the General Atomics deal, the government wouldn't even have to consider other bids. In San Diego, I'm Jill Replogle.
Afghans and Iraqis who work in their countries with American troops often place themselves and their families in great danger by affiliating themselves with the U.S. So there's a reward for this work, an easier time getting U.S. visas for themselves and sometimes for their families. At least that's what's supposed to happen. Jill Replogle reports on the 2-year quest of an American veteran to get an Iraqi family to safety.
They called the lanky, too young-looking teenager Roy. During 9 months of firefights, raids on enemy compounds, and long nights on watch in Iraq, Roy interpreted the country's language and culture for the platoon led by U.S. Army Captain Blake Hall. He helped Hall identify the signs of a hostile neighborhood and impending attacks. The two became very close. Hall admired Roy's witty one-liners, but even more so, his bravery.
Not allowed to carry a weapon in combat. And still, you know, with bullets flying overhead, faithfully doing his job right by my side, I don't think I'm that brave. I know I'm not that brave.
When Hall's tour was over, Roy wasn't yet eligible for a special visa offered to Iraqis who worked with U.S. forces. He still had 3 months of combat work left. So Hall returned to the U.S. and began the paperwork to bring Roy over. Then one day, he got an email. Roy was dead, killed in a bombing along with 6 American soldiers.
I felt like I'd just been punched in the stomach.
Hall says he spent the next 18 months numb, trying to process his combat experience and his loss. One thing kept nagging him, his promise to Roy.
And ultimately I decided I needed to find his mom just to tell her how important he was to us and how special he was. Really, in some ways, to ask her for her forgiveness. I still felt very guilty about leaving him behind. He's the only member of my platoon I didn't bring back.
After much searching, Hall finally got in touch with Roy's mom. She didn't hate him, as he had feared, but she and her family were in danger. Iraqis seen as U.S. collaborators are potential targets for insurgents. Hall vowed to get them out of Iraq. He worked with pro bono lawyers and the nonprofit Iraqi Refugee Assistance Project. When things seemed to stall, he called legislators and went to the media. Hall says the long wait is unacceptable.
And every one of them that's hunted down, every one of them that has to live in danger or has their quality of life diminished because they served with Americans, it's a tarnish to our national honor.
According to the Iraqi Refugee Assistance Project, Iraqis who worked for the U.S. and their families, if they apply for refugee consideration in Iraq, will have to wait 18 months just to get an initial interview. And it still takes at least a year after that before they complete the process and potentially get on a plane. In Afghanistan, under a special visa program for Afghans who have worked for the U.S. government, there's a backlog of 5,000 applications just to apply for the program. Roy's family waited nearly 2 years to get refugee status, and now we're at the San Diego airport waiting to meet them. Roy's aunt and grandmother are already here. They left Iraq several years ago and now live in San Diego. Roy's cousin, who was also a military interpreter in Iraq, has flown in from El Paso, Texas, to be part of the greeting committee.
Yeah, they're coming.
Airport construction drowns out their arrival. Hugs and kisses are passed around. Roy's parents, his 11-year-old sister and 22-year-old brother, the family looks exhausted. They've been traveling for nearly 40 hours. At the apartment where they're staying, the women bring out plates of food, rice croquettes stuffed with ground beef and almonds, and a kind of Iraqi pizza. They order us to feast. As it is for most refugees, finally arriving in a new country is a mixed bag.
Happy or sad?
This is Roy's mother. Her name and those of the rest of Roy's family will remain anonymous. Other members of the family are still in Iraq.
I happy to future of my children, but I'm sad to future of my country. It's bad, really bad.
In the next few weeks, a local refugee resettlement agency will help the family get oriented, find an apartment, get Roy's sister enrolled in school, and help his father start looking for jobs. For now, Roy's family is relieved to be safe, and they credit Hall for that. The family's first night in the U.S. wears on. In the morning, they'll start the rest of their lives. In San Diego, I'm Jill Replogle.
Coming up on Fronteras, we hear from a surgery resident in Texas who says he's had a not-so-common immigration experience, and he's still not sure what the future holds for him.
My mother's a very smart woman. She says if you want to make God laugh, you should tell him your plans. It's a one-day-at-a-time thing.
Salvador Sordo's immigration story and what it reveals about doctors trying to live and work in the United States. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano told a Senate Judiciary Committee Wednesday that the border is more secure now than ever before. But she says it still needs work. From Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
Senators grilled Secretary Napolitano about incomplete border fences, taking deportation too far, and not taking it far enough. Many challenged her definition of border security.
Fewer people are trying to immigrate illegally in this country than in four decades. Drug seizures, contraband seizures, all the numbers that need to be up are up. And what I know is we're actually removing more people from the country than ever before.
But Napolitano said the immigration system is out of date. She argued for a mandatory electronic employee verification system. She also supported stronger employer sanctions and an improved legal immigration system. The sticking point for several lawmakers is whether to allow a pathway to citizenship. Jose Antonio Vargas also testified at the hearing. He's an activist who has written extensively about his plight as an undocumented immigrant.
I feel as if we've been having the exact same conversation on immigration for the past decade, as if immigration is all about border security. I came here from the Philippines. My border was the Pacific Ocean.
Steve Case, who co-founded AOL, told the committee, when we talk about immigration, we can't ignore the economy. He says half of technology companies are started by immigrants.
This really is about the future of the country and how do we seize this opportunity to remain the world's most entrepreneurial nation.
President Obama urged Congress in his State of the Union address Tuesday to come up with a bipartisan bill for him to sign within the next few months. I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
Salvador Sordo says his immigration experience has not been typical. Sordo is a surgery resident at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio. He's doing research on the Division of Trauma and Emergency Surgery. Sordo moved to the United States in 1994 with family from Mexico. He says his dad was invited to open a corporation here and was given an H visa for years. When Sordo turned 21 years old in 2000, he could no longer stay here under his dad's visa. He tells me his career began when he was at this crossroad.
So at that time, I had to make the decision of changing career paths or going back to Mexico for medical school. I felt my calling was medical school, so I went back, graduated from medical school in Guadalajara. And after that, after doing 2 years of rural service, I proceeded to pass the U.S. medical license exams and apply for a resident spot here at University of Texas.
So you are working, or you're a surgeon resident in San Antonio, Texas. And tell me a little bit about what are your next steps. Do you want to become a U.S. citizen?
Currently, the type of visa in which I am in the United States, it's not different from any other physicians. It's a J visa. What a J visa entails is that your country essentially loans you to the United States in order to be trained and then go back to your country. There's a requirement of a waiver of 3 years in the United States for once you graduate prior to being eligible for any other type of visa or immigration status. So usually the path that is followed after you complete the 7 years of a surgical residency, you go to an underserved area in the United States for about 3 years, and then you start applying for other immigration status.
When you hear all of the talk about immigration reform right now, is there something you feel is missing from the debate?
Well, the current talk is about DREAM Act and the illegal immigrants that are in the United States. It usually talks about the 11 to 12 million immigrants that are living here and what would be the steps that need to be taken in order to get them legal status. Same way they talk about the DREAM Act. However, nothing is really talked about with regards to people that try to come here in a legal way. There's talk about the STEM Act, which is basically science, people that have a background or graduate in the United States from science, technology, engineering, mathematics, to facilitate the process for them to stay in the United States. I feel that this country would benefit greatly from having trained, educated professionals stay in the country to create jobs here and help the United States rather than them having to go back to their countries and trying to find an alternative way to come back if that's what they want to do.
So, I mean, we hear about doctor shortages and surgeon shortages in the U.S., and from what I'm hearing from you, it doesn't sound that easy for these doctors and surgeons from other countries to come and become U.S. citizens.
Well, in reality, you cannot, if you're a surgeon in another country, you cannot just pack your bags, move to the United States and practice. There's quite a bit of requirements that you need to have. Actually, if you were a surgeon in another country and you wanted to be a surgeon in the United States, you have to do your whole surgery residency once again. You have to do it over. And we actually have many members of our surgery program that are actually doing that. There's people from Egypt, Iraq, Mexico, Venezuela, countries, people that are already fully trained surgeons and are back here doing the training once again in order to stay here. The shortage of physicians and in the nationwide level in the United States sounds like it would be a reason for immigration officials to actually encourage surgeons to stay in the United States and work here, especially since we are all United States trained professionals. However, at this point, that is not necessarily the case. There's still a lot of paperwork and lawyers and different legal maneuvers that have to be taken in order to be able to stay here.
And I understand your family, they're all U.S. citizens. Is that right?
That's correct.
And that doesn't make your path easier, any easier?
Not necessarily, because the way that the immigration law is right now, once you become a J visa, which is what I have right now, you have to finish that commitment prior to your immigration status changing. So regardless of my family being citizens, or if I decided to marry, if I fell in love and married a United States citizen, that doesn't change things. On the contrary, if I was not to stay in the United States for those 3 years and I chose to go back to Mexico for another two, I would have to bring my wife to Mexico.
Wow. So tell me your plan.
My mother's a very smart woman. She says, if you want to make God laugh, you should tell him your plans. It's a one day at a time thing. Currently, my visa gets renewed every year as long as I show progress in the surgery residence. I have another 3 years to go prior to graduation. After that, the plan, at this point, I want to do a fellowship in trauma and critical care. After that, I would have to do the 3 years of the waiver and then find a sponsor in order to be able to stay in the United States. If I'm not able to do so, I'll go back to Mexico and take the skills that I learned here and take them somewhere else.
If you could speak to the White House administration, to the senators working on this immigration reform bill, what is the one thing you would want to tell them?
I think my position is very different from people in the DREAM Act and illegal aliens. I believe that people in the United States should not be afraid of illegal aliens. Most of them are here in order to do better, do work. And a sense of fairness, just because this country was created by immigrants and the immigration has not stopped. I would acknowledge, I would try to make them realize that they are running the country that everybody wants to come to. They should try to have the good people come and stay.
Is there a possibility that immigration reform could change your path to citizenship, I suppose, that you're aware of?
Well, if the STEM Act actually takes effect, there's various points that are in the STEM Act as far as having graduated from high school here or a college here, which I would qualify for those. However, at this point, as I said, I have a J visa, so I have to complete my surgery residency prior to be and do a 3-year waiver in an underserved area prior to me being able to convert to a different type of visa.
That was Salvador Sordo speaking. Sordo is a surgery resident at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio, Texas. You've been listening to Fronteras, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting-funded journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KNAU Flagstaff, KNPR Las Vegas, KRWG Las Cruces, KUAZ Tucson, and KSTX San Antonio. Fronteras is online at fronterasdesk.org. We're also on Facebook. We invite you to join the conversation and post your thoughts about our stories. For headlines and updates, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is fronterasdesk. You may also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.